The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
9:23. Thank you for all your texts, by the way. You're busy there this morning, which is great. 51551 being the text number. A cockroach in the Palace of Westminster wakes up one day to discover he has transformed into the Prime Minister. Well, of course he has. The plot of Ian McEwan's novella, The Cockroach, is a Brexit-inspired retelling of Kafka's metamorphosis. And Ian joins us now. Good morning, Ian. Nice to talk to you again.
Good morning.
Is Brexit for you an addiction, or is it a trial? Is it a joy? Is it a horror show?
It's an addiction and it's a horror show. How about that?
Yeah, well, that'll do for starters. When you wake up every morning, tell me about what's filling your head of it.
It's like the reverse of when it's your birthday. You wake up and you think, now what is that thing that's oppressing me? Ah, yeah, Brexit.
Isn't it extraordinary though how something that is kind of relatively abstract can be so invasive to not only a person but to a generation?
Well, it's abstract now, but it's going to get concrete, if, assuming it happens, to people's livelihoods and so on. So, yeah, I published the book, I think it's tomorrow.
Yes.
And there are some elements of Brexit which are just beyond satire. And last night it moved from satire and satiring itself to a kind of horror show.
Tell me a little bit about, if you would, The Cockroach, and then we'll take it from there.
All right, well, there's a prime minister, he's called Jim Sams, and his body's taken over by a real hard Brexiter cockroach who's really thinks he wants to get things going. And 25 of his mates have taken over the whole cabinet, and it's really the story of how they push through. It's not Brexit, their project. I've invented something that I hope was equally absurd, not quite sure I succeeded, called reversalism.
Yes.
The cockroaches and their party want to reverse the flow of money. So you pay for your job, and you go and get the money by going to a shop, buying things, and they give you the money, the retail cost of the things, and with that money you go and buy yourself a job.
And the police pull you over.
The police pull you over for speeding, hand you a couple of £50 notes, and you're just going to have to work some overtime. You're not allowed to hoard money in any way.
Yes.
Anyway, it's a completely insane project, especially when you come to trade with other countries. They have to send lots of money with their exports. But they push it through with reversalism in one country, a nice old Leninist project.
And the Clockwisers?
So the Clockwisers are us Remainers, really. They want the money to flow in the old direction, but they lose out.
And President Archie Tupper?
Well, he's a very familiar guy. He's a dab hand with a tweet. And Jim Sams has to actually look seriously at Tupper's tweets to understand their poetry and compression of language and puerility.
And did you alight on the use of the word and the creature, the cockroach, with relish? Or did you have a short list of creatures to go to?
Well, something ugly and alien has entered into the spirit of British politics, and a cockroach seemed a good enough creature. But I was standing on giant shoulders. I mean, my very first sentence echoes the very first sentence of Kafka's famous novella, Metamorphosis.
Yes.
So, you know, one day Gregor Samsa wakes from uneasy dreams to find himself transformed into a giant creature. I sort of reverse that. This is a cockroach waking up to find itself turned into a man, a prime minister.
I recall reading your book Saturday at the time of the Iraq protests and the million people outside, and it didn't feel as political, if you like, as this in terms of a reflection. Mm. Obviously, the Iraq war was for you just unpalatable, etc. But how does Brexit, if you can compare the two, but certainly at least at your own breakfast table of a morning, compare in terms of the body politic in Britain and big decisions made in Parliament?
Well, there's a big distinction to make. That was a war. This is a kind of political squabble and sort of political fight to the death. We've only lost one, and that was Joe Cox, shot and stabbed to death in the street by an English nationalist extremist.
She was referenced last night, as you know, in Parliament.
Yeah, so when a Labour MP, a woman, stood up to say, you know, you must moderate your language, Prime Minister, because the words that are being used in death threats are often echoing your own language. she was making a very, very serious point. Death and rape threats from English nationalists to women MPs have become very common. And his reply was, I've never heard such humbug in all my life. I think he really crossed the line there. I mean, this used to be the party of law and order. And it's now set its face against the judiciary. It's playing to a core, I suppose. That's what it's imagined it's doing. It's very, very calculated, but it's become extremely thuggish. And I really do think the spirit of the cockroach is in the air.
Yeah, and just to finish, I suppose what you were saying there was that Johnson said that the best way to honour the memory of Joe Cox was to get Brexit done, to which Mrs. Cox, the late Mrs. Cox's husband, Brendan, who was on this programme not too long ago, tweeted he felt sick at her name being used in this way.
Yeah, well, I mean, she was a Remainer anyway, and that's a sort of careless, stupid remark. But, I mean, it was just one among dozens last night. An extraordinary scene in Parliament. I mean, sickening.
Let's have a little flavour of that, if you don't mind, and we'll come and reflect on it in a second.
The party opposite does not have confidence in the government. They will have a chance to prove it. They have until the House rises. They have until the House rises today to table a motion of no confidence in the government.
What are you thinking listening to that, Ian McKeown?
Well, I mean, he's speaking from a position of great weakness. I mean, the Supreme Court judges not only delivered a judgment, they made law, and more power has now passed to Parliament. At the same time, the Conservative Party are a minority government, with a huge undersubscribed by in votes. And we all suspect that he wants to drive through no deal. It doesn't look like he's going to get a deal. To do so, he would have to break the law. The Parliament has passed its act, making it necessary on him, incumbent on him to ask for an extension if he does not get a deal. Mm-hmm. No one can quite trust him on this. So clearly the opposition are going to hold out from an election until they are absolutely sure that he's going to follow the letter of the law. No one can quite assume that he does. And, you know, all he's got left is this taunt. I mean, it's quite a powerful taunt. If you don't like me, then pass a vote with no confidence.
I presume are you a card-carrying Labour voter?
No. I vote all over the place.
Okay.
Centre and left of centre, sometimes Green, sometimes Lib Dem, sometimes Labour.
And how do you...
I don't belong to the party.
I understand. And how do you feel about the state of the Labour Party? Their party conference, which has been characterised as pretty chaotic, but between Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party, broadly speaking, do you think that what shape would you describe it as?
I think it's in pretty poor shape. It rather filled me with despair. I've been very angry about momentum and the Corbyn party. We really did need a sensible grown-up party who would just hold up this process to greater scrutiny. Right at the beginning, 2 or 3 years ago, when he voted with the government, whipped his own party to vote with the government to set the whole two-year clock ticking away, I thought, this is crazy. You should be pressing the government for what kind of Brexit they want. Because people had the vote, yes or no, great mistake, but there it was. Binary question, yes or no, to the EU. And it's up for Parliament to deliver what kind of EU we get. And that really needed proper scrutiny before we plunged into this two-year period.
Go ahead, Dave.
I was going to say that, unfortunately, the government kept saying we've got to keep the whole position that we're holding here a secret, as if we were playing a poker game. Meanwhile, the EU was spreading out, you know, these are our terms and conditions. Mm-hmm. This is what we want. And there's no reason why we couldn't have done the same. It was not a card game. It should have been an open negotiation, which we all could have watched.
We have a particular interest, obviously, with what's known as the backstop. I'm sure you're familiar with it.
Yeah.
And there is a sense that, I think on this side, I don't think it's unfair to say, broadly speaking, that the likes of Boris Johnson and maybe the people he surrounds himself with really don't understand this island and us as a people.
I'd go further than that. I'd say they don't even care. And the Tory party members who voted for Boris Johnson, who were constantly polled during their little campaign, said that they would rather have a no-deal Brexit even if it led to not only reinstating of the wall, the border, mm-hmm. a hard border, they didn't even care if it destroyed the Tory party. So my feeling about this is that we have entered a mystical stage with Brexit. You no longer hear anyone giving economic arguments for it. They've all died away. We're leaving because we said we're leaving, and we are leaving because. And that's it, really. Because. There's nothing left. It's not going to change our immigration much. It's not going to give us more sovereignty. Trade deals are always a compromise with sovereignty. Everyone knows that. So it's gone kind of misty with a touch now of blood and soil. It's gone really weird on us.
It's weird because there's so many places to go with this conversation, but just briefly on the, you're talking about blood and soil and fighting them on the beaches maybe. The fact that Boris Johnson's great hero is Winston Churchill, and he tries to channel him, but I can think of no one more opposite right. to Winston Churchill.
Absolutely. I mean, the great thing about Churchill was that he could bring people together with some very powerful rhetoric. What's happened here and what's especially happened last night, so divisive now. It's more Trumpian than Churchillian. Mm-hmm. It's an appeal to your core, to your base, the hope that, you know, that sort of thuggish attitude and casting your opponents as enemies of the people and so on, that old trope, will rouse your core to stick with you. I think a lot of women, I think he would have lost a lot of women voters last night.
Because of the Joe Cox behaviour?
Because of the Joe Cox thing and that appeal from the Labour MP to just moderate your language. In fact, he did the exact opposite.
Yeah,
I think a lot of women would say, God, we cannot possibly vote for such a man.
I was interested in what you said to me a minute ago, if I may go back a couple of steps, Ian, about the Irish border, because people like myself and no doubt yourself down through the years who would have tiptoed over the border and back, depending, and on occasion would have had the rifle of a young British soldier's gun peering through your driving window asking, where are you going?
I remember it.
You remember that?
That
is a sincere, authentic and real fear for people in terms of a hard border coming back. And for you to say that your own Prime Minister doesn't care actually, frankly, fills me with a certain amount of dread.
Well, I honestly think that it's a minor issue for him and a minor issue for his passionate supporters. They just think it's an irrelevancy. It's another country. It's across the sea and they don't know much about it. And so it's fallen behind. But in fact, I mean, the reality is, the political reality is that this is the sticking point and he's just going to have to get his mind around it. I mean, the EU made what to me seemed like a perfectly sensible suggestion, which is to have the border down the middle of the Irish Sea, that was turned down. The DUP, speaking for actually a very small part of the North, very much against it. Sinn Féin, of course, not taking their seats in Parliament. That would have been helpful if they did, I think. Who knows? He might come back. There's just a chance he'll come back to Parliament with Theresa's made deal with a couple of fig leaves on it. But I think that the language has got so extreme now that in Brussels, they'll be looking at this saying there's no chance.
The fact of the matter is, as you well know, that the majority of people voted for Brexit. I mean, that's democracy. The majority of people in the electoral college voted for Donald Trump. Don't mind the popular vote for a moment, but the facts are as they stand. So you calling it, as you call it, is I suppose, in the minority opinion, as a matter of fact, that the people have spoken. They want out.
Well, 37% of the electorate spoke. The problem for us who wondered deeply and seriously about the result was that it's such a complex issue affecting not only our constitution, but our trade, our science, our securities, every element of our public life. And to run this referendum on the first past the post vote was a total absurdity. But we have to live with that. There it is.
Yeah. Welcome to our
world.
But we
had two or three years of argument.
Yes.
And really, people ought to know now more than they did before. And we really ought to look at this again and have a second referendum, as the Irish, of course, honourably did.
And on a couple of occasions. I've noticed the text from a listener, Ian, says, "We are leaving because I stamped my foot and I am 4 years old."
That's very good.
Very pithy.
Well, she said it better than I ever could.
That's it. But I think there are times where you have to turn, as you have in your latest novella, The Cockroach, you have to turn to the dark corners of humour to try and make sense of it and to try and kind of hold a mirror up to it, because sometimes reality is just that. It's too real.
Well, you remember Jonathan Swift's Modest Proposal.
Oh, you're right.
Which I think is the sort of seminal text of despair. It's where despair and laughter meet.
Yes.
Comes that point. And it's from exactly that place that I wrote The Cockroach.
I'm just going to take a couple of more messages because people are very engaged in this subject in Ireland, as you can appreciate. Ed says, if you want to get Churchillian as far as Brexit is concerned, never in the field of political endeavour has so much damage been done by so many, to so many by so few. Etc. And that's a point well made. And of course, another from John says, power tends to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely, which is the old adage. Seeing that, as says Brian O'Rourke in Wicklow, seeing as there's difficulty on reaching agreement on Brexit, why isn't there any chat about negotiating the issues that created the need for the referendum? That way, creating a stronger Remain lobby. The way I see it, 40%+ voted Remain. Roughly 25% of the Leave vote had concerns about particular issues and could easily be swung to vote Remain, thus pushing Remain to 50%+. Yeah, much easier to fix a problem than create a potentially bigger one. Stephen says, have they forgotten how bad it got during the miner strike? Of course, you wrote about the 80s in your last book, and most recent book, which is earlier in the year. Do you see a sort of a comparison there in terms of the enormity and the effect on the body politic?
Yeah, I mean, that was a turbulent time too, but I think this is going to the roots of our constitutional settlement, and therefore is beyond just a sort of parliament versus unions versus workers issue. I mean, the miner strike raids, enormous questions about policing as well. But this goes much deeper now. I think we really need to regard the whole matter as a big mirror that's held up to our democratic settlement. And if the dust ever settles on this, we need to take a good, long, hard look at ourselves. Years ago, I was hiking in Ireland, and at the end of the day, I turned on the television with my Irish hiking friend, and there was Mary Robinson inspecting the guard, a barrister. And I watched transfixed, because everybody said when Jacob Rees-Mogg and others went up to Balmoral to see the Queen, that the party, Conservative Party, shouldn't be dragging the Queen into politics. Mm-hmm. Well, I've just had dinner, I have to say this, with the President of Iceland. And I asked him what would happen in Iceland in a constitutional crisis. He said, well, I would have to be involved. I would have to take decisions. Now, the Queen, amazingly, we're very lucky that she has lived through 15 prime ministers. And actually, I'd like her to be a bit more active as a head of state. And when Rees-Mogg said we'd like to prorogue Parliament for 5 weeks, I would like her to have raised an eyebrow and murmured, hang on, why 5 weeks? Explain to me. In other words, I think if you have a good head of state who's above politics, but at certain times needs to step in, not just take the advice of the Prime Minister.
Yeah, I mean, she just is one of those monarchs, it seems. I mean, we don't know any other one in our lifetime, but who is a light touch regulator when it comes to these matters of state, it seems. But not an unintelligent person, incidentally.
Oh, absolutely not.
Yeah.
And with colossal experience,
right.
Far more than the whole cabinet put together.
Right.
So, I don't know. Of course, I wasn't there. Maybe she did do that. But she's, I guess, by convention, bound to accept what's called advice, although it's more like, please, can you just rubber stamp what we intend to do? But anyway, that's null and void, as Lady Hale so beautifully put. One of the most stirring speeches in recent public life that I can remember. I listened to it with a tear in my eye, really. I think suddenly the grown-ups were in the room.
Well, now, that is an expression I would use a lot when I'm chatting with friends about the world politics. There does seem to be a lack of grown-ups in the room.
Yeah.
At the moment.
So suddenly there were 11 of them. I mean, judges without experience are to be unanimous across a spread of 11 is quite extraordinary. I mean, you would expect a couple of dissenting voices and dissenting judgments. This was absolutely straight down the line. They felt that this was unconstitutional, illegal, and it was said, and not a touch of humility either with the Prime Minister or his members of his cabinet. And I think it's fairly disgraceful from the party that once was the party of law and order.
And now we have, I mean, you've mentioned the word thuggish a couple of times in our chat this morning, Ian, and I think it's an interesting choice. Having watched Peaky Blinders, where Oswald Mosley has raised his head in dramatic, right. You know, but a very timely reminder, the language, the passion, the articulate thuggishness.
Yeah. I mean, one should always be careful in a political argument to start calling your opponents fascists or Nazis.
Yeah.
But I think there is a path down which you take a couple of little baby steps, and that path is where you appeal over the heads of your legislature to the people, and that's the sort of first and most important distinguishing feature of boneheaded populism. And this is where we're at. He's taken a few baby steps in a very nasty direction.
The people who are up for Brexit and want to leave, they must dislike every word that comes out of your mouth.
Yeah, I mean, I remember that we had our referendum while we were still in the thick of austerity.
Yes.
And lots of people were suffering wage stagnation, overcrowded waiting rooms, health service, not many policemen on the street and so on. They were never going to press the button for the status quo. And the sleight of hand, really from the tabloids, really was to blame Brussels, not the British government. And there were many things about the British state that were wrong. And somehow people were persuaded to blame Brussels. And I think they were very mistaken. I think we can still continue to have a civilised debate outside Parliament. But inside it, at the moment, it's hell.
Ryan, from the start, I always felt Boris, this is from a listener, didn't care about Ireland. Ian McEwan is one knowledgeable man. And Teresa says, lovely, sincere interview with Ian McEwan. He sounds dispirited. First person to sound completely truthful about Brexit. Looking forward to his novella. Sending him best wishes. Almost as if you're in your own personal crisis.
I am.
You sound very downtrodden almost, Ian. It's, you know, or weary.
Well, I'm not weary because I'm too addicted to this. but my spirits, I mean, I speak to a lot of my friends, and of course we're all in our echo chambers.
Yes.
Most of my friends are, in fact, Remainers, I have to say. The one or two who are not, I avoid a little because I just cannot bear to lose their friendship. But lots of people say this has really seeped into the private corners of my life. I have to speak for myself here. A while ago, I was in, again, with my same Irish hiking friend, Ray Dolan, a very distinguished neuroscientist from Galway. And we went to Slovenia to do some hiking and a bit of trout fishing. We got in our car. We're going to a remote place. And I was driving. We'd been going for a little while. One of us said, wait a minute, we're in Austria. So we had crossed the border, and I stopped as I was turning the car around. I thought, what an amazing political settlement this is.
Yes.
This continent torn apart by the most vicious, cruel war in the mid-20th century had made it possible that you could drift along the old Eastern Front into Austria, now a democracy, too. We could have gone on to Portugal. We could have driven up to Sweden. No one would have asked to see our passport. What an amazing thing it is. Of course, it's a human institution, all its deficiencies are there, but it's a wonderful, rich civilization. Much more interesting to drive across Europe than to drive across the United States, I have to say,
yes.
Which is homogenous with McDonald's in every corner. A rich, old, troubled civilization. And I'm cross about having my European citizenship removed from me. Yeah. I didn't ask for it. I mean, I think of identity as a set of concentric circles. The self, family, grandchildren, then neighbourhood, then I'm an English novelist, even though I had a Scottish father, I'm British, and I'm a European.
Yeah.
I was.
You were once, and that's quite a bleak, isn't it? I was. But, two words.
On the upside,
so
let me just say.
Yeah, give us an upside.
We can still drive around Europe. We can still drive around the Schengen group.
I mean, if that's your upshot, you really are goosed.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh,
could you not? Could you not lend me or give me an Irish passport?
I tell you what, it's a shame you said your grandfather was Scottish, because for a minute there, if you'd gone the other way, it could have been all a very different end to our interview.
Yeah.
Ian, it's always good to talk to you. Your reflections are intriguing. The book is just, dare I say it, fun. The Cocker, it's 100 pages, not going to bother anyone for too long in their day,
no.
But it'll stay with them, that's for sure. It's good to talk to you. We'll see you in Ireland the next time. You probably have to queue a little longer to get to your flight.
Yeah.
But safe travels.
Okay, thanks a lot. Bye.
Thanks a lot. Nice to talk to Ian McEwan there. Such a great writer, one of my favourite writers. My shelves are full of his books, and we've spoken a couple of times, but I think that insight into where Brexit world is, I really enjoyed it, because it felt we were at the heart of the matter from somebody who's really thinking about it a lot. All right, so much engagement by text, by the way. You obviously were enthralled by what Ian had to say, which is great, and we will reflect on those in a moment, back after this.